and as I explained during the talk, does form the foundation of my four novels, We Shadows, Dance Macabre, Artificial Gods, and Flash Wanton Boys. I look forward to doing a sequel when I have more sequels out, because I continue to do this sort of research, and I have a very comprehensive Bible now. Let's get right to it.
So, this is called Illuminating, Not Illustrating, the Night's Dream series, subtitled, Oh, You Thought I Made That Up? Because, which is fair, I'm like, alright, for years people are like, I would give these monster panels, and then people would be like, oh, do you have books about that? I'm like, no, I just think it's cool. And I'm like, I tried writing a book about the little stories I know, and then I got depressed because I felt like I was a vulture writing about this girl who died in a water tower. So I'm like, I can't do that. And so I'm like, wait, why don't I actually just do a panel about the weird stuff that's actually in my books? It took me years to figure out that that's a thing I might want to do. So that's what this is all about. And in researching this again, I'm like, I'm pretty sure I did make that up. Let's be clear. Reality is copying off me now. Here's me with Bigfoot at the International Cryptozoological Museum. We're good buddies, Bigfoot and I. I'm probably not too crazy. I probably don't believe like 65% of this, and about 98% you can independently verify. This is not like personal Gnosis. Like, you can look this up. I did. So, relatively free of corpses. In previous years, there have been corpses in my, like, straight up dead people, frozen, torn apart. We're not doing it. It's too mean. All right. So, I also have these uniting questions that I hope to answer. So, did a mathematician and a psychologist invent a medieval peasant to move their furniture? Let's see if I can prove that or not. All right. So, basically what happened, I have the crew here. If it were projected, you could see it all. But these are all fairly normal people. A mathematician, A.R.G. Olson, and a basically convinced Dr. Joel Witten, a psychologist, like, we should create a ghost. And the guy's like, that does seem like a thing we would do. Now, they weren't friends prior to this. It was very much like, you're a scientist. Let's see if you can disprove what I'm doing. Like, I'd like you there as a control so we don't just go crazy. ARG Olson's wife was there, a chairperson of Mensa, a student. Some of these have last names. Some of them just went by last initials because you don't really want to be attached to, yeah, I tried to make a ghost. You know, and this is actually like, this is actually them. Like, and so the ghost they made was named Philip Aylesford, a medieval peasant, who they decided they would give characteristics to. They gave him a history. They were basically character creation sheet in D&D. So Philip, which I've made from Philip Seymour Hoffman here, because there's only one drawing of Philip Aylesford. So they said he was born 1624, early military career. He was knighted. He was friends with Charles II. And, you know, just to twist that knife, like you're going to fictionalize somebody so make him miserable. He was in love with a frigid woman named Dorothea. And so then he met a Romany girl and they fell deeply in love. But then she got burned as a witch, after which he committed suicide. I don't know. It seemed like you're creating something out of whole cloth and you gotta make him sad. But they did. And at first they had no success. They sat around, they're like, all right, Philip, speak to us. They got the Ouija board out. Nothing. And so then the psychologist is like, what if we treat this like a real science? Like, dark room, candles, hold hands, be real spooky? And that worked. Then they were getting, the planchette was moving, the table would move, they would hear raps. This is a ghost rapping. I'm good like that. They would hear unexplained echoes. And so that is pretty much successful. Now, this isn't just a personal thing that they did. No, they took the show on the road. They did this on stage. People would come and watch them summon Philip, who never existed before. And once they did this, Philip could talk about his history, and he could talk about things that happened in that era that they probably didn't know about, but he had severe, like, lack of knowledge. So he didn't know things in his history that they didn't tell him, but he knew what else happened in 1624-ish. Which they said was pulling from some kind of like Union collective unconscious, because They didn't know it. So, obviously, that's pretty cool. You made a ghost. So what do you do next? You create more ghosts. So they made Lilith, a French-Canadian spy during World War II, Sebastian, a medieval alchemist, and all of these two could answer questions about their time periods. But my favorite is Axel, a man from the future. Because you're already making up a ghost, he might as well be a time-traveling ghost. But I can't find, like, I don't know what they asked these other people, especially Axel. Like, if Axel can give information as to his time, you can make some good lotto money. I've seen Back to the Future, too. I know what to do here. So, that's a fun little story. Then, oh, it was made into two movies. It is based on two movies, The Apparition and The Quiet Ones, neither of which seem to involve Philip. I think it just involves We Made a Ghost, which I'm sure that they're great movies. I didn't bother getting them on my Netflix queue, but I'm sure they're great. Now we're bringing it into my territory. This is what is called, depending on your level of cultural appropriation, a tulpa. People don't like when you call them tulpas. In ceremonial magic, they're egregores, or a thought form. Basically, if everyone collectively believes something, it kind of manifests, which... we'll talk about how that involves my books. So yeah, just anything you really believe in takes form. And this idea of a tulpa came from a woman, well, was brought to the West by a woman named Alexander David Neal, who was the first Westerner allowed in Tibet, where she studied Buddhism pretty much until she died. But they told her, like, this idea of thought forms, the Tibetan monks. And she's like, all right, I think it's fair to try that. So what I'm going to do is, she imagined a little Friar Tuck looking monk who would just follow her around. Like, she really visualized it, like what he looks like, how he acts, how he sounds. And she did this for months, and then she started seeing him, like basically hallucinating this little monk. But that didn't stay that way, because tulpas have their own kind of autonomy. So he turned into a tall, lanky, kind of pointy looking monk. Which, and she's like, oh, this isn't good. And then other people in the camp are like, so who's that guy we keep seeing around your tent? And she's like, what guy? And then described the monk. She's like, I need to get rid of him now. So she figured out how to banish him. And apparently that stopped. Like, if you create something, you really need to make it go away, or it takes on its own life. I brought you into this world. I can take you out. Making ghosts, making something you believe in enough. Basically, it's a poltergeist. You're making a constructive poltergeist, except you're not a 13-year-old girl whose parents are repressing her sexuality. But yeah. So yes. So your parents, none of your parents care. But if there were children here, I'd be like, your parents don't want me to teach you how to make a ghost. Come to my booth for unrelated reasons later on. So yes. So yeah, this is a big foundation of my books. That they're all about collective belief. Like, as the more you believe in something, the realer it becomes, which is why, like, gods can walk around, because you believe in them. But it also, I call it the Tinkerbell effect in my books. In my head I do, but it hasn't actually made it in my books as such. But basically, if you disbelieve something, it hurts it. Just like in Peter Pan, where, you know, you have to say, I believe, or Tinkerbell dies. So if you believe, it has strength. If you disbelieve, grows weak. So of course the magical things do not really want to be outed as magical things, because then you're like, there's not magic. So it starts in We Shadows. Alright. Are any of you Catholic? Alright, then I'm going to make fun of poor little saints. Alright, so I should have had a different heading here. Alright, so how did Portuguese children give the Vatican the willies with a sunny saint? I think that's a pretty accurate description. Alright. So this happened in Fatima, Portugal. So stop. Collaborate in Lisbon. Yeah, I will not apologize for that. I had to. But yeah, it's not actually, it's over here. Lisbon's down there. Still. All right. So what happened is Lucia Santos, Francisco, and Jacinta Marto. She's the cousin of them. I'm pretty sure I have them correctly labeled, but I don't know. This is the only good picture I could find of them at this age. So these are the prophets, not the suckers. That would be mean. So basically what happened is they started having visions. At first, it was a woman brighter than the sun who would speak to them. Let's see what she said to them. This happened in 1917. They were visited three times by an apparition in the spring, calling it the Angel of Peace, the Guardian Angel of Portugal. And this angel taught them prayers, told them to make sacrifices, and to spend more time adoring the Lord. And these are little, like, shepherd peasant children. These are not educated children. In May, the Virgin Mary stepped in. Real heavy hitter. And they saw her with a white mantle edged with gold, and then she held a rosary, which, I mean, I guess, but it seems like, you know, if it's your son there, it's a little on the nose, Mary. Just so Lucia told them all to keep quiet, keep this to themselves. But Jacinta, being like a 10 or 11-year-old, is like, no, I'm going to tell my mom. And her mom gossiped to the neighbor who gossiped to another neighbor. And then it was everywhere. So pretty much all Fatima Portugal knew that these kids were seeing something, or they were crazy. So the Virgin Mary said to return to the cove where they first saw her on June 13th. And the priest is like, yeah, let's let this happen. Let's play this out. Let me just see where this goes. Oh, and so then the Virgin Mary, or whatever they saw, said, Francisco, Jacinta, you're going to die soon. Lucia, you have to survive to tell the tale. But yeah, you got this little 10, 11-year-old, and you're like, yeah, your number's up. Sorry. Yeah. So gets to live to spread the message of Virgin Mary killing her cousins. Also, while she was at it, she showed them a vision of hell that terrified them. You know, and she entrusted them with three secrets which were good for some and bad for others. Also, while the Virgin Mary was there, she decided to nag Lucia's, like, you need to learn how to read. So, you know, that's pretty mean. You know, get good. So, this got spread around. Again, that we saw this. This is what the angel told us, or the Virgin Mary told us. And so they were supposed to go for an August visit. They got arrested. Because, and horribly interrogated. And this was actually Jacinta's mother set this up with the police. Is like, yeah, we need to shake my daughter out of this. Virgin Mary told her she was going to die. I don't want that to happen. So, yeah, basically the police arrested and tortured them to try to get those three secrets out of them. And Lucia said, I can tell you everything except the three secrets till the Virgin Mary gives us permission. I guess the idea was that Portugal had recently, like, had a revolution, was now sort of a secular democracy. And it was thought that this was trying to bring theology back into Portugal. And so, of course, you use 10-year-old children to do that. You know, that's how you do it. So, yeah, they were in prison, so they couldn't see the Virgin Mary. Instead, the Virgin Mary showed up 6 days later because she has a busy schedule. She could not possibly fit them in any other place. So then the Virgin Mary told them that people are in hell because people on earth aren't praying for them. Which is kind of a weird message, because people on Earth were praying for Charles Manson, but you're probably not praying for the nice mailman you knew when you were a kid. So he's burning in hell, and Charles Manson is good. So in total, they saw the Virgin Mary 6 times. 2017 was the 100-year anniversary of this. That doesn't mean anything, it's just a fun fact. So in October, she showed up again, and she's like, I'm going to show people a miracle to prove that I exist. Which, of course, got all over the place. Newspapers reported it. People, secular and religious authorities, came from all over the world. And both groups are like, you guys are making this up. This is not a thing. You're crazy, or it's a political gambit. Stop. And this was called, I'm sorry, this happened in October, the Miracle of the Sun, on the 13th of October, 1917. So this is the Miracle of the Sun, reported in the newspapers. And so it was more of like an Obama inauguration crowd than a Trump inauguration crowd. 30,000 to 100,000. It's a little bigger. Just packed everywhere. And the kids are like, I see Jesus and Moses and the Virgin Mary. No one else was seeing this, but the three kids were. And, you know, Then the miracle happened. Do I have it here? Oh, they have a basilica. We'll get back to that. Good. So what they saw, some people saw the sun spinning in beautiful colors in the sky. Some people saw the sun moving around, like circling, spinning. And some people saw nothing. And your belief had nothing to do with what you saw. Like, you could be completely devout and you just see a normal sun. Or you could be a complete skeptic and be like, okay, something's happening with the sun and I do not know what it is. There is one photo of this phenomena, which I could not find, but apparently just shows the sun in the sky completely normally. Incidentally, scientists felt the need to weigh in and be like, yeah, the sun didn't do anything weird that day. I guess it had been raining just before. The sun came out and supposedly everyone's clothes got dried. I'm a little skeptical there. There are people here who are like, it was a UFO, this whole thing, aliens. It's probably not aliens. Just throwing that out there. So some people say it was retinal damage, that you have these people staring up at the sun. So that's going to mess up your eyes. So then you're seeing trails, you're seeing spots, you're seeing colors. Don't look up at the sun. Don't do it. Some people feel like...
You screen up a little for those that are sitting.
Yeah. So some people think it's, I think it's called like a sun dog or a fire rainbow, where basically, you know, the light hits the water vapor at the right angle, you see a rainbow. Not really a miracle. Cool, but... So in 1930, it was declared worthy of belief by a bishop. By 1946, the Pope did a canonical coronation to the image. I'm not really sure where that ranks. And it was made into a minor basilica in 1954. So then it was decided, like, yes, this is something you're allowed to believe in. It's not a heresy to think that this is a miracle. And I think the children were canonized as saints. I'm pretty sure. So good for them. You just had to die for it. So yes, creepy kids. This would be better if you could see it. It was big.
But yeah. Did two of the three actually, like, die?
Say? Yes! They died of the swine flu of 1918. Oh. Which we will get to. Actually, I'll save that. But yeah, so they died pretty quickly, as they predicted. And they, of course, they told their parents, yes, we're going to die soon. Which is creepy. If your kid comes to you and is like, the woman in the sky told me we're going to die soon. I don't know, you get that kid an exorcism. Oh yeah, so they were beatified in 2000. They were canonized in 2017, 100-year anniversary. So now they are saints. And thus I'm a blasphemer for teasing the poor dead saints. So after their deaths, Lucia went to a Catholic school, then joined a convent because she was a saint. She needs to stay devout. She kept having visions, most of which they're like, yeah, you just don't tell anybody what you're seeing. All right, so the secrets. This is not like the secret. These are the secrets. So one... First secret, hell's not a pleasant place. Big secret, nobody wants you to know. Shh. Hell, unpleasant. Second secret, if you want world peace, you have to... What's the word I'm looking for? You have to make all of Russia become Catholic. They must all be consecrated to the Immaculate Heart of the Virgin Mary. To which the Russians are like, nyet. Yeah, so that did not happen. And so it's like, well, that's why you had a World War II, isn't it? That is basically how people feel. But the third, and these two were released in 1930, which is a little late. But there's one more secret. And at first, Lucia's like, oh, yes, this secret can be released in 1930, gave it to the Vatican. It's like, it'll make more sense then. And the Vatican looked at it, bishops and such, fainted dead away, like blanched, were horrified, and they're like, we are never releasing this ever. No. So the third secret was kept under wraps. And so people speculated, what could this third secret be? Does it explain when the apocalypse is going to happen? Does it explain when Catholicism is going to get destroyed? So, it could be released in 1960. So they did not publish the third secret, a four-page handwritten text, until June 26th of 2000. So they waited 40 years after Lucia said, you can release this, to release this. And It said that someone was going to try to assassinate a pope. Which is, you don't faint dead away reading that. You'd be like, well, we got to make sure we got those cool little pope mobiles. We need a pope mobile. You don't faint reading that. So people think that, yes, they made this up, including Pope Ratzenberger. John Paul the something. I don't remember him. But when he was a cardinal, he said, I actually probably have it here. Pope Benedict, I'm sorry, the 16th. He's like, a careful reading of the so-called secret will probably prove disappointing. So he did not read it, but he's like, it's going to disappoint you. And the line that I like is, its meaning is exactly the opposite of a fixed future. It is meant to mobilize the forces of change in the right direction. But again, he didn't read the secret, and more than likely this four-page handwritten document had nothing to do with it. But, you know, you want to cover up the secret that makes you faint. So who knows? So yes, this is actually a big part of my book, Flash to Wanton Boys, where instead of the Virgin Mary, it is an angel who is trying to set this all up to bring about the swine flu of 1918. This is briefer, and it's not paranormal-ish. It's just terrifying because it almost killed us. So how bad was it? So it killed between 5 and 10% of humanity. And we'll get to it, but it pretty much drove everyone crazy because, like, they shut down schools, they shut down theaters, people wearing masks. And actually, they dug up frozen corpses from this to figure out what had happened. And it's something called a cytokine storm because it mostly left babies and old people alone. But if you had a healthy immune system, it ramped that up to 20. So your immune system kills you by fighting so hard that your body can't stand it. And so, you know, I think your lips turned blue, your lungs filled up with fluid. It was a horrible way to die, and it happened quickly. And they weren't really sure where it came from or where it went. We didn't cure this. We didn't stop it. It just stopped. And so the fear is it could come back. And we're not much better at it. The Surgeon General of the Army said, if this epidemic continues its mathematical rate of acceleration, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth within a few weeks. The swine flu is probably why the Allies won World War I. Because it killed more people in the trenches than warfare did. And it, I mean, obviously terrifies, like, you're getting it, your friends are dying, it's spreading everywhere, because we really don't have babies or old people in the trenches, usually. So yes, here we have a man refused to don an influenza mask, and so a cop pointed a gun at him. Serious, or, you know, you didn't get onions. Onions are clearly the cure. We'll have a truck of onions, and you just get as many onions as you can. So that's probably not going to help. It is thought that some people were immune, because some people are immune to most anything. And it's thought that they were the survivors of the bubonic plague. They were the descendants, not... If they survived the bubonic plague, then they're definitely not a young person. So yes, it's thought that that's why. A fun anecdote from this. For me, as they were trying to figure out exactly how is this caused and what can we do. So they're like, who can we experiment on? I know, prisoners. So they found prisoners who had very long sentences, and they said, all right, how about we slightly reduce your sentences if you let us try to infect you with the swine flu? And so they volunteered, some of them. And the first thing they did is they had someone infected cough on them. Didn't infect. Okay. So then we're going to have them, like, basically spit in your mouth. No, that didn't do it. Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to take some tissue from a dead person and put it in your mouth. No, didn't do it. Inject it. Didn't do it. It killed zero prisoners. It killed two doctors. The problem being that the flu had already gone through the prison. So anyone who was going to die from it had already died. So, I kind of feel like there's justice there. Oops, sorry. So, Yes, this was terrifying. You know, theaters were closed, schools were closed. Oh, and there was a fun little nursery rhyme. Obey the laws and wear the gauze. Protect your jaws from septic paws. Crazy. And it's also called the Spanish flu. I don't really go with that. Because World War I was happening, Spain was neutral. And they're like, yeah, we're having a crazy flu. Are you guys? And the other sides are like, we don't know what you're talking about. What flu? We're not weak. You're weak. But since they were neutral, everyone that gets the Spanish, it came from Spain. Spanish people. It even killed the Spanish king.
Other countries were calling it like the Italian flu.
Right. Propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I heard that the Axis countries didn't want anyone to know, so they kept
yeah.
the information suppressed.
But we could have died. Like, our that is one of the most recent times that our species was starting to get to that bottleneck where we may not be able to recover. I mean, mathematically, it only killed 10% of people. And, you know, even now they're not really sure. They're like, maybe it came from Chinese people. It seems to have come out of Kansas, maybe. We're not really sure. We just know it's gone for now. So how's this in my... So I think in my series that the swine flu was made to try to kill the supernatural elements of the earth. That... You know, the healthy people infected, some of them were people who, you know, were like tree sprites who were just trying to live normal lives. But like the cytokine storm, it just makes the belief go too high for them and they kind of explode. You know, it's too much belief. I'm getting too strong. In the first chapter, the first like prologue, it sets a guy on fire. It just burns the beddies in just because it excites it so much. So, yes.
Oh, is that why that?
Yeah, the swine flu. Cytokine storm. See? I don't make these things up.
Makes sense, man.
Maybe you should.
Right, doesn't it? All right. Now we're going to get into my jam. Did the great beast and an alien bring us to the moon and enslave Hollywood? The answer may surprise you. All right. So we're going to start this chronologically with Alistair, the Great Beast 666 Crowley. And that is what he called himself sometimes. He's got an honest face. I like him. But yes, he believed, like, pretty much every paranormal, not every, like, occult sort of thing ties back to Crowley. A lot of new pagan religions were definitely, like, seeded by Crowley. Because he would just combine legitimate rituals that existed prior and you try to stick them together because it's all just belief and creativity. So popped it all together. He basically made the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. He made a religion that still exists now called Thelema. I think that's my next slide. One of their tenets is do what thou wilt. There's a second part called in accordance with the law. People forget about that. So yeah. So what wilt thou do? Many, many human beings. Just maybe a goat. We're not sure. I don't want to speculate there. But yeah, Crowley definitely was like all about the debauchery. That's where power was. He had, since we're all adults here, he had one ritual I've read about where basically he has sex until he passes out. Then he has oral sex to wake up again. And then he has sex until he passes out and then oral sex to wake up. And you just do this until you're in a religious stupor. Or until you stop convincing young girls to let you do this to them. Which didn't happen. Like, Crowley's very successful at this. So, that brings us to Aleister Crowley's honeymoon. Because this guy, this Ketch, actually landed a woman. I'm impressed. I mean, obviously, oh, you're the Great Beast 666 and you want to have sex with underage girls. I'm going to put a ring on that. That sounds good to me. On his honeymoon, he did something called the Amalanth ritual. I got it. The Amalanth reworking in 1917. Like when the swine flu happened. Oh, and when the Virgin Mary appeared. That's weird how they all connect. And so the Amalanth reworking was to open up a portal to let interdimensional creatures into this world. And he said that one appeared named Lamb, that guy right there, big head, squinty little pig eyes. And this is not like from imagination. He said that this being physically appeared in his room and let Crowley, like, draw a portrait. Like in Titanic. Incidentally, while I was looking, you know, because obviously this looks like it compares to what we think of as graves. So this guy here, and this, I did not search for this, this guy here is an alien that was seen in the Hudson Valley. Because this is a UFO corridor. And again, I was not looking for that. And I'm like, I already had the picture in there. And then I'm like, oh, the subtitle says Hudson Valley. Because this is a weird place to live. So yes. And even the Thelemites, they still say, Lamb is a great old one whose archetype is recognized in the accounts of UFO occupants. So again, I'm not speculating. This is what the Thelemites think. They have a way that you can contact and commune with Lamb. You basically just look at this picture until he starts to speak to you. So, you know, just take a good long look if you want to hang out with the space alien. Or whatever. So let's see. So that's all preamble. That's prologue to the meat of this. Jack Whiteside Parsons, born Marvel Parsons. He actually changed his name to something less weird. His father was named Marvel. His father really doesn't appear more than that. He was basically raised by his mother. He was raised in wealth. He was a very rich kid. Just, you know, not super rich, but rich enough that you can sort of do what you want. He was born in 1914. And he had a taste for explosives. He had an intuition for explosives. And this meant that he got kicked out of Brown Military Academy for Boys because he blew up the toilets. Like you do. By 17, he was enrolled in university school, and he flourished there. On weekends and holidays, he worked at the Hercules Powder Company. Because the boy can't stay away from explosives. But sci-fi inspired him to start working with rockets, which was ridiculous. Okay, let me just go back. I don't want to spoil you on that one. So yes. What was ridiculous, we'll have a slide, it's just not in order the way I want it to be. That it would be like, yeah, I'm gonna go work with lightsabers and portal guns. It was science fiction. No one believed that rockets had any relevance. They were a toy. Aside from like Flash Gordon, you don't think there are rockets. That's ridiculous. And so even he actually dropped out of school because of the Great Depression so he could earn money for his mother. But he was raised wealthy, so I don't know. And so, but he had such an intuition for explosives. Like, he could combine chemicals in such a way that it was miraculous what he could do. And so he hooked up with a guy from Caltech and another, like, a trained person who's like, look what I can do. They're like, that's impressive. And so Caltech gave them a lab to work with. And the other people at Caltech referred to them as the Suicide Squad. Probably not this Suicide Squad, but we don't know. And because reality is heavy-handed, they conducted their rocket launches at Devil's Gate Dam, which is now supposedly a portal. But yeah, Devil's Gate, because apparently there's a rock formation called the Devil's Face near there, which does look kind of devilish and
craggy.
Where is there? California? I want to say California.
It says Los Angeles County.
So, California.
Okay.
Thank you. The so distance. Far it's far. It's far from here.
It would be cool if it was in the Hudson Valley.
It's true.
I know. We'd all be getting in the car and that now.
We would.
Field trip.
So yes. So Fritz Vicky, who is a famous scientist, said that it's ridiculous that rockets cannot go into space. Science has proven this. Why are you trying to get us into space with rockets? You're being ridiculous. A lot of people then... and stupidly now believe we can't go into space because of the radiation around us. One page that I researched on either had amazing detailed biographical information or explained how we never went to the moon and Stanley Kubrick pretended. And I mean, brought this up because Jack Parsons founded something called the Jet Propulsion Lab, which the United States government found really interesting because he was being incredibly impressive and successful. So the United States government bought Jet Propulsion Labs and it became NASA. So this man, who was an acolyte of Aleister Crowley, He moved from Marx. He was religiously searching. He moved from Marxism into Thelema, and he's like, "Yes, this is the thing where I get to have sex with people. I like it." And he was a handsome fella. So yes, he had a lad. Probably wasn't his lad. That's not a great one. Supposedly, he was also the inspiration for Howard Stark in the Marvel Universe, which you can kind of see, you know, Iron Man, rocket-powered, and Jack Parsons looked just like that. Handsome guy, mustache. So interesting. But, sorry, stop. Let's see. So, he actually, Jack Parsons, at Caltech, created something called Galsit 53, which was less volatile and 427% more powerful than any previous rocket fuel. So that's impressive. Let's see. Oh, we'll get to her. She's... Oh. All right. She's... Well, I mean, it's back in the day. So Helen Northrop was his first wife. I'm not actually sure if any of his relationships after this are legally binding, but he was legitimately married to Helen, who seems like a really nice girl who's like, we will now join the Agape Lodge and we will conduct debauched rituals. She seems just like the sort of person to do that, right? She's... So, they joined the Agape Lodge, which was a subdivision of the Ordelis Temple, or the OTO, I don't know how to pronounce it, but which was Crowley's group, Crowley's organization. Or actually, the organization Crowley took over, because Crowley was very good at being like, I like this, it's mine now. And people would follow him, because Crowley was apparently charismatic, even though he looked like Uncle Fester. He does, though. So, he started the Agape Lodge, which he joined the Agape Lodge in 1941, and Crowley's like, I like the cut of this guy's jib. Also, he keeps giving me so much money, and he's got a big house. So in 1942, Jack Parsons, was the head of the Agape Lodge in California. At which point, Helen's 15-year-old sister, Sarah, or Betty, if you hate, like, because she had two names that, like, yeah, Sarah or Betty, which made research much more difficult, because I'm like, what happened to Sarah? Why isn't she in the notes? Who is Betty? But interchangeably, since I have Sarah here, we'll try to call her Betty. 15 years old. And not only were the Northrops like, yeah, our 15-year-old can go move into your debauchery house. That sounds good. They're also like, we will fund this. We will fund your Agape Lodge. So I don't know what kind of parents give not one but two daughters to this den of iniquity, but they did. With the money that he got from Jet Propulsion Labs, Jack Parsons bought a mansion that he called the Parsonage, which is where the Agape Lodge was. The Parsonage has since been knocked down, and it is now condos. But, you know, that's probably fine. Surely nothing horrific is going to happen there. While it was the Parsonage, he advertised, because he had, like, I think 19 rooms, and he's like, I want bohemians and artists and atheists and Satanists to move in. Anyone moral cannot live in my house. And I think he just let you live there for free if you were debauched. There is one story that supposedly an underage boy ran out saying that he had been repeatedly sodomized by people in the house, and the police brought the young boy back, and they're like, Mr. Parsons, what's all this about? And Jack Parsons is like, listen, I work for Jet Propulsion Labs. I have good money. That kind of stuff doesn't happen here. And they're like, that's reasonable. Please take this boy back. The police are not good at that kind of thing. So, supposedly there's a portal to another dimension there too, in the condos. So I don't know if the homeowners organization covers that one, but I think you have to cover that. So yes, this is before every rocket launch, Jack Parsons would recite the hymn to Pan, which is a spell that Crowley came up with, which I'm sure freaked people out when you're doing rocket launches. Also, the Galsite 53, he combined asphalt with liquid fuel and solid fuel to create something, but he found that it burns really well if you just have an empty star shape in the center. And he's right, it does, but probably just a coincidence that it's an inverted pentagram here. Surely. Surely just a coincidence. And it is legitimately why we got to the moon and why we're still in space. So, Hal Northrop, we covered his wife. She was into this. You know, wife, not even wife swappy, just everybody has sex. Everybody. One of the things that was reported at the parsonage is the neighbors would be like, there are naked women playing with fire, conducting witchcraft. Again, Parsons is like, no, there's not. It's just, it's probably a party. It's, don't even worry about it. And they didn't, because he had money. So then we get into Sarah Betty, who we'll call Betty for now. Crowley, again, the great beast 666, who did horrible things constantly, said that this woman is a vampire and is the most disgusting, immoral creature he ever encountered, this little 15-year-old Betty. And Betty really took to being at the lodge. Let's see. So by 17, she was a second-level magician, and that's when she started a torrid affair with Jack Parsons, because Helen, her sister, had gone away for a little bit, and when she got back, Jack Parsons is like, listen, I really like banging your little sister. Awkward. You should leave. This is just terrible. And so Helen Northrop left with the original head of the Agape Lodge. It's just like, fine, I'll just go over there. And then she just exits this narrative. Like, she's really not heard from again. I'm sure she had a nice life with the other guy. Who knows? And Jack Parsons wrote in his journal, using both first and second person, Betty served to effect a transference from Helen at a critical period. Your passion for Betty also gave you the magical force needed at the time, an act of adultery tinged with incest, and served as your magical confirmation in the laws of Thelema. Dude, come on. Yeah, so bang the little girl. Who was, again, Crowley's like, she is literally a vampire. Not figuratively, literally a vampire. Crowley thought she was bad. Now, at the same time, a man named L. Ron Hubbard, who you may have heard of, happened to encounter the parsonage, the Agape Lodge, and was 110% down with it. He's like, I can have sex with all these girls. I just left the Navy, and I'm feeling a little bit impotent emotionally. Just loved it. He's like, there are cult rituals. I like that. Let's do it. Yes. But he mostly liked, you know, having sex with people. And Crowley thought, this is a con man. This man is disgusting. Again, if Crowley thinks you suck, or that you're evil. So one of the people who were at the Agape Lodge at the time said that Hubbard was living off Parsons' largesse and making out with his girlfriend right in front of him. Sometimes when the two of them were sitting at the table together, the hostility was almost tangible. Because even though you're not supposed to be jealous, there's some jealousy, there's some issues going on there. So yeah, L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons were definitely frenemies. They got together, I think I digress here a little bit into, so what happened is, L. Ron Hubbard, after something called the Babylon Working, which we will get to, this is all very important, trust me, this one. He's like, oh, and we already talked about how Parsons got kicked out of Jet Propulsion Labs, which he founded, and they fired him because of this weird occult stuff. And so he was running low on money. So he'd like, and L. Ron Hubbard's like, listen, I was in the Navy. Here's what we're going to do. You're going to give me $20,000. I'm going to go over to Florida. I'm going to buy yachts. I'm going to bring them back here where we'll sell them. And Parsons is like, yeah, that story checks out. Here's my money. Oh, I'm also going to take Betty just to make sure this goes off as planned. You cool with that? And Parsons is like, yeah, that sounds great. Months later, Parsons is like, L. Ron Hubbard, are you coming back? And Hubbard's like, no? What? I bought a yacht. We're good. And Parsons was furious. So obviously he tried to sue them. He wanted the police involved. The police are like, we can't get it to him. International waters. Sorry. So Parsons is like, okay, here's what I'm going to do. And summoned up a hurricane that knocked them back to shore, where the police arrested them. For theft? I don't know. He did just give Aaron up fraud? I don't know. So then they hauled Betty and L. Ron Hubbard into court, and he sued them successfully-ish, because he only got like $2,000, between $600 and $900 back, basically because Betty went up to him and was like, you know you were having sex with a child, right? Do you think the court should know you were having sex with a child? So Parsons is like, nope, we're good. You can do, nope. So got the almost $3,000, and that was that. He had to sell the parsonage to make up for it. And he just said, like, yeah, you can have the parsonage. I just want an apartment over the garage, because he clearly became like a college student moving back in with his parents. Oh, at the same time, Parsons is like, I had a prophecy. I remember it's like, I had a prophecy, Parsons. You're going to blow up in a fire. Which, I mean, is probably a fair bet. You know, maybe not psychic as much as duh. So yes, then L. Ron Hubbard forms Scientology. Or Betty, who, she's called his first wife, but he was married at the time that he married Betty. So more like second wife. And his first wife didn't really know, but I think the Scientologists were like, nope, that's the first one. He never had a wife before that. And during this time, Betty was like transcribing. L. Ron Hubbard is legitimately in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most prolific author. That doesn't mean he's the best author or a competent author, but he wrote like 1,068 books, something like that. And Betty was like taking transcription. And at the same time, we talked about how L. Ron Hubbard was having some emotional issues in his regions. And so she was like taking dictation and writing it all out. And basically the book that more or less Betty wrote and L. Ron Hubbard slapped his name on was Dianetics, which formed the foundation of Scientology. And people who are familiar with Thelema and the occult rituals of the Agape Lodge are like, hey, a lot of what we're doing seems a lot like what's in Scientology. That's funny, right? So it is thought that Betty basically is like, all right, let's get the Agape Lodge elsewhere. Let's get you suckers into it. And so they had a terrible marriage. He kidnapped her baby. He kidnapped and brainwashed her. He had her tied to a chair, starved, refused to let her sleep, and is like, just say that you will not divorce me, that you want to be a good wife and do what I tell you. And she brought him to court. And then she disappeared for a while. And when she came back, she said, no charges. I was lying. I take everything back. Yeah, pretty much every guy in the story is just a prince, aren't they? Yeah. So let's go back a little bit to the Babylon working, which is what Parsons decided he wanted to do. Did it go too far? No. Okay. The Babylon working is basically, I'll be delicate here. Parsons was going to wave his wand around while L. Ron Hubbard took dictation from this, trying to summon forth the Scarlet Woman, the great whore, Babylon, as spoken of in Revelations. She seems nice. And so they did this for a while, basically Parsons masturbating in front of L. Ron Hubbard for a month while L. Ron Hubbard wrote it down. Whatever. To make this woman appear. They went out into the desert once, like going whole hog of Parsons masturbating in the desert. They came back, and in the parsonage was an artist and actress named Marjorie Cameron. She mostly went by Cameron. She's cool. And Parsons is like, well, I was looking for this immense manifestation of like divine infernal energy. But you've got red hair and green eyes, so that's probably good enough, right? And so for 2 months, basically, no, 2 weeks, he and Marjorie got to know each other, and they were apparently very happy together. And he said, and the whole point of the Babylon working is to create something called a moon child, which I think will hearken the end of the world, maybe. Not really sure. Basically, it's a bad thing. It's like the evil version of Jesus. And depending on your sources, either Marjorie Cameron never got pregnant from this, or she got pregnant and had an abortion. However, people, including Marjorie Cameron, and this happened in about 1946, 1947. In 1947 was the beginning of modern ufology, where a pilot near Mount Washington saw objects which looked like manta rays skipping like saucers on a stream, which then were reported as flying saucers, which then people saw flying saucers and not little manta rays. Incidentally, this pilot, they always leave this part out, he said, oh no, those were living beings from a place we go before, where we are before we live and after we die. And I'm like, that probably would have changed ufology if that part of your quote got it. But Marjorie Cameron is like, yes, that's what we did. We made UFOs happen. So, and there's one story where that she tells that she and her brother were on a hike and suddenly a portal opened and what we would call a UFO popped out, and she felt this immense like satisfaction and love and relief. And she knew that this is what the Babylon working did. It brought UFOs into this world. And they're still here. So Marjorie Cameron, cool beans, cool person. And Marjorie Cameron believes this. The Thelemites still believe that Lamb is the manifestation of alien energy. So the fact that all these things kind of dovetail is weird. This is the 2% that I cannot 100% verify, but this is what they say. This is what they think. Incidentally, about the Babylon working, our friend Crowley said, apparently Parsons or Hubbard or somebody producing a moonchild. I get fairly frantic when I contemplate the idiocy of these goats. So yeah, Crowley is like, where did I start? Why? Why are they evil? Why are they stupid? Why? So then we're going to go back to 1946, 1947, where he's had a little bit of a relationship with Cameron. And then, depending on who you ask, the fact is he blew up. Mercury fulminate made him blow up in his mom's basement. Now, either he was just experimenting with a new kind of explosive, or he was trying to commit suicide, or it was a successful magical ritual. Marjorie Cameron's like, no, he was murdered. Like, not a question, he was murdered. Since we're all adults here, this is not verifiable, but it is reported that when the police were going through the ashes, they found a box that had pictures of his mom having sex with Parsons and a dog. But that's probably just slander. But that is reported multiple places. These were horrible. Parsons' legacy, because Jet Propulsion Labs, NASA, they're like, yes, there's a man named Jack Parsons, and that's about it. There is a crater on the moon, Parsons Crater, after him. That's nice. But mostly he gets nothing. So I feel like that's not the ending I really want here. He died at 37. 37. Yeah, and I just feel like he could have done so much better and been much weirder. But yeah, just he blew up. Which I guess is the end he was going to have, you know. Play with fire, you explode in your mom's basement. So the person I feel worse for in this whole thing is Marjorie Cameron, who really, like, she was just having fun. Like, she wasn't evil or mean. She wasn't Betty Northrup. She wasn't L. Ron Hubbard. She wasn't Jack Parsons. She was just an artist having fun, having sex with this guy, and, like, hanging out in his big house. I don't know if they actually got married. I couldn't find verifiable things. But she did remarry, she had two kids, but after that, she just sort of, she lost something in herself. She sort of gave up a little bit, and, like, she stopped caring about feminine things. She just wore what was comfortable. She didn't wear makeup, she didn't shave. She's just like, no, this is who I am. I want my body to age and decay. I'm good with this. There is a quote that I'm going to read to you where she found out that one of her friends got cosmetic surgery, and she said, "You can erase the lines, but the pain is still there." Which I think is a really good Marjorie Cameron quote. But yeah, she was, I forget what book, movie, she was in movies, and she's a talented artist. Do I not have that? She's a, somewhere. Just trust me, she's a talented artist then. She's my computer background right now. Hi, Marjorie Cameron. So yes, this is really a big part of my book, Artificial Gods. Like, it is the foundation, the Babylon workings in there, some of this history is in there. But what is weird is I wrote and finished the book, and then I was on StumbleUpon. If anyone remembers that, you basically just click and it shows you a random web page, and suddenly Lamb showed up. And I'm like, wait, I'm not going to go to sleep yet. What is this? And then I read the page, and I'm like, but that's what's in my book. Like, I said that aliens were, like, these supernatural beings, not aliens. And it was all there. And I'm like, I'm going to go back in my book and I'm going to make sure it all, like, I'm going to put this all in there. And it was already all in there. So I do not know how I did that. That makes me a little uncomfortable.
Aliens,
it's got to be.
You are the spawn of aliens.
I am the spawn of aliens. So the fact that that, I mean, I've been reading about UFOs forever and I know about Crowley, but I don't know how I would have, like, I didn't know about this Parsons thing per se. But, you know, Crowley, aliens, causing aliens to exist, yeah. So, yeah, that's in there. Even the part where if you look at the picture of Lamb, you can commune with him. That's in my book. That happens in my book. So, I'm going to wrap this up with, I did more research for Artificial Gods. Y'all should read that book. It's my best book, I think.
Me too.
Is a portal to Mars a county way? So, if you've talked to me before, while I was researching, I knew that Artificial Gods was a book I wanted to write because I had a friend who was like, oh, did you know that Pinebush, New York has UFOs? And I'm like, the deuce, what do you mean? She's like, here's this ridiculous book called Silent Invasion by Dr. Ellen Crystal. Her doctorate is in New Age music, but I mean, it's more than I have, so good for her. And as a grad student, she went there almost nightly to Pine Bush, where people were seeing UFOs almost every night. Like, it was reliable. So much so that Orange County, possibly still in the books, outlawed skywatching. Because people were parking next to the road on West Searsville, which was a very active street. They were setting fires on other people's lawns, you know, to keep warm. They were trespassing where they didn't belong. So it was illegal. It might still be illegal. I couldn't actually figure that one out. But, yes, this is, I don't think this is actually a UFO, but roughly a triangular-shaped UFO was seen in the early, like, 85 to 86, was seen in the Hudson Valley. I mean, and this was seen by literally thousands of people who were otherwise reliable, like police, teachers, and mass sightings, like many people would see it, pull off to the side of the road, and just look at this giant, silent triangle. The official story that people go with is, this was ultralights flying in formation. Which, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it sure as hell is not ultralights flying in formation. Because, one, ultralights are very loud. They have basically lawnmower engines. And you can't easily fly in formation. Like, even if you have a stealth fighter or something, you can't really fly that well in formation. And people also said that it was not transparent, like you couldn't see stars through it. It was a big triangle blocking out the stars. So I think this actually is one of the ships, which you will note is not triangular shaped, but it is weird. This is an ultralight. There's no way that this can fly information. So there was a book written called Night Siege, which is so boring, and thus I think it's reliable. Because if this was like Salish, if it's like, oh, the aliens came down, we talked to them. No, it's like, I pulled my car to the side of the road and I saw an object in the sky. And then it tells that from like 10 other people's reports. It's tedious and I love it. I do. Jalen Hynek actually was, I mean, he's a doctor. He's a legit doctor. And he was employed by the government for something called Project Blue Book, which is supposed to I don't want to say debunk UFOs, but at least it basically is why it's like, you know, 95% of UFOs can easily be explained because of that. And that was his job. Like, he was a skeptic until he came to the Hudson Valley. And when he came here, he's like, I have no idea what people are saying. This is crazy. And so he sort of became a believer, and he wrote this. My one issue with this book is the name Philip J. Imbrugno, who is a middle school science teacher in Westchester. Or if you ask him, he's an above top secret special agent for the government. Except everything he says about his military service is not remotely verifiable, and he has no idea about military stuff. But you know, do you. Except that it completely destroys the credibility of a lot of things. Like, you have one really reliable guy who got suckered in by this man who, when he was, I want to go with defrocked, but that's not the right. When his petard was hoisted, he was in the middle of writing a book with a woman named Rosemary Ellen Gluley, who has a lot of, like, witchy books, about how the CIA uses genies that live in caves. And I'm like, wait, so that's not the thing that ruined your credibility? People were fine with that. It's the fact that you made up your military service. So yeah, he probably made up a lot of stuff. And so most of the Hudson Valley UFO sightings kind of ebbed after 86-ish. But Pinebush just picked up. And Pinebush is a fairly small town. At the time, it was more rural, farming-based. Now, most of the streets are occupied. There are condos. It's a nice place, and very rarely do people see UFOs. I have gone to a couple sky watches with the Pinebush UFO people. The first Wednesday of every month, they meet at the Walker Valley Schoolhouse for their meetings. The United Friends Observer Society, or UFOs, very clever, who are parodied in Artificial Gods, and they have never noticed.
Really?
Yes. But whatever. Hopefully they never figure it out. But yeah, so they meet and they discuss their UFO issues. What was weird, I went to the first of their meetings, and everyone went around and they talked about, like, their experiences with UFOs. And then the meeting was over, and I'm like, wait, we didn't talk about anything. Someone's like, oh yeah, I saw a UFO. Okay, move on to the next person. And that's all they did. It was like 2 hours. We went around, the room was packed. I think the room is always packed. And there were definitely a couple of other tourists like me, where I was just like, I have nothing to say. I don't know what's going on. But I did see one person, like, writing on a piece of paper, like, these people are crazy. And I'm like, okay, I'm not alone here. But yeah, mostly I'm like, I need to keep a low profile. I'm just doing research. But yes, I went on sky watches with them where they saw UFOs and I saw airplanes. They did explain to me that the airplanes can disguise themselves using plasma as UFOs can look like airplanes, but they never get the lights right. But if I can make my ship look like a plane, I can get the lights right. But they say no. Whatever. So now Pinebush, well, the Pinebush has the Pinebush UFO Fair, which originally was run by the UFO people. And it was, they met in like a consortium where ufologists all over the world would come and discuss the phenomena. And they did this for maybe 2 years. And the town is like, wait, you're bringing a lot of tourists in here. Okay, you guys are done. We take it over. So now it's really cute and family friendly. There's a big parade. It's fun. There's alien balloons. It's really cute. Yeah, it's really cute. You should go. It's in May. I think it's May 23rd this year. Or May 19th.
I think it's May 19th.
So yes, this is where my book is set, in Pinebush. And I did this research and I combined it with Aleister Crowley summoning an alien. It's a good book.
This is my panel titled Illuminating the Night's Dream series, which was performed at No Such Convention 2018. On the schedule, I think it was called Illustrating the Night's Dream series, which, if I had a graphic novel, would be a very good idea. But as it stands, this was the panel on which I focused most of my attention. And that's it. It was a great crowd, a small crowd, but people who have read my books and are interested in what I'm talking about. If you ever get a chance to go to No Such Convention, I highly recommend it. And not just because I give such stellar talks.